Hello, I'm James St. James. This is Night Fever, New York nightlife legends of the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, the co-founders of World of Wonder, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. Hello, chums.
Hey, guys.
Good to see you both. Yes, I am very excited today. Our guest is a legendary drag queen from the House of Avians. She is a dance music icon with chart-topping hits like Cunty and my favorite, Din-da-da, din-don-di-don. He has appeared in Madonna's secret video, which we're going to have to talk about. He is a survivor of a horrific 2006 gay bashing, which really rocked the LGBTQ community. And he is on a career high right now, having been featured on the new Beyonce album Renaissance alongside Wallebrity's T.S. Madison and Big Frida, which is so exciting. We've got so much to get to. Welcome to the show, Kevin Avians.
Hello, 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 hello.
Honey, I have been trying to think when we first met. And I have narrowed it down to 1990 in Washington, D.C. at Tracks. Could that be it?
No, it was that we actually brought you guys in to go to our party called Kindergarten.
Kindergarten. Now, was that with Sister Face?
Actually, that was with Jean-Philippe Avians and Paul Avians, who's not with us anymore, and Nita and Dee Dee. And these guys were, they were just a group of kids I hung out with. Yeah, Sister Face was part of the party, but that part of that party, but she was part of the DC party. I mean, I slept on her stomach for many years. So
did I come with Connie Girl and Princess Deandra? Was that the trip?
No, you came with Amanda Lepore.
Okay.
And a couple of other people I can't remember.
Okay. Now, let me see. Let's get to the Kevin Avians.
I'm glad we cleared that up. I'm glad we cleared up your...
Yeah. Well, no, because I remember coming to D.C. one time and I had a very a sexual experience with some boy that I picked up at the club. And I wasn't sure if that, and I was going to go into that whole story.
They said that happens in D.C., but that wasn't with me, girl.
Okie dokie. Okay.
Yeah, but James, before you go on, Kevin, what was your impression of James? If that was the first time, I'm assuming you knew him by reputation, but.
The first time I met him in New York was when he wore this pizza outfit.
Oh, that pizza outfit, yes.
He was eating some pepperoni. I was just like, girl, that's not real. It's real. It really messed up with the whole thing. But when I met James in D.C., he had a wedding dress on, and the dress was just like tattered. But it wasn't like tattered in like someone beat her up. It was really tattered like fashion. And that's when I was like, oh, this piece no joke. She's carrying.
I remember because I remember that wedding dress. It was a little bedraggled by the time I got to DC. If you say it was fashion, I love that, but it was pretty tattered.
This dress was just like held it on like the two little pieces or something like that.
That's funny.
Miss Havisham.
Yeah, Miss Havisham indeed, yes. You were born and raised in Richmond, Virginia. With a big family, big, huge family. How many siblings?
There are eight of us, but one of us passed away last May.
Oh, Kevin, I'm so sorry. But you did have a lot of music in the family, right?
My playground was my basement and albums. So we had like a whole wall full of albums. I mean, like 3,000 or 4,000 albums, ranging from disco to country to everything, opera, everything. So that was my playground. I didn't have to go down to the playground and play with kids. That wasn't my thing. I hated being a kid, actually, but I just wanted to be, you know, an adult. And so I had to wait. So in the basement, I did.
you were in the church choir, weren't you? You sang in the church choir?
I did.
That always is a grounding experience, and that always gives you a lot of it builds, you know, your voice and everything.
Church is a celebration. It's a place where I go to, like, you know, they're teased with the religious and all this stuff and the gay and all that. My church wasn't like that. My pastor always told us, you know, all I can do is teach how to, you know, conversate with God. That's all I can do. That's all I can do. You know, it's up to you and God what kind of relationship you have. You know what I mean? So that's why church was such
a important place. I love that.
Yeah.
And then you moved to DC. When? What year was that?
That was, I guess, 89, 90.
Mm-hmm. And that was, but you were a part of the track scene there as well, right? As well as kindergarten?
Yeah, the track, I was born, in the volleyball court at tracks, jumping in out of a trash can, singing Black Betty. Go on, Black Betty, Redman, go on, Black Betty. And that's how I became a little club kid. And it was just like, you know, I saw RuPaul came to town and she was doing Star Booty. And that was really like, okay, like, wow, this is really fierce. And then we did a ball, and that's when Paris is Burning had come out. And so we were already the House of Aviance. I met Peppa and Dorian Corey and all those guys. They brought them to DC to me, and they were just so amazing. They're older now, but they were just so, I guess they were really kind of not feeling well. So, but they were so fierce. I mean, when the lights
went on. Well, I was just going to say, you've got to tell me about, you know, like actually meeting Dorian Corey and Peppa LaBeija.
Dorian Corey was like, all I remember, I'm sorry, see, my dad's very fair skinned. She reminded me of my dad's family. Like this light, high yellow, light skinned black woman, you know, it was a very, very interesting way of talking. And did all this blonde hair and this eyeliner, like just went like. And she was like, she didn't feel well that night. And then with the light, they called her to the stage and she came to life. These feathers started popping up everywhere. And she just shook herself, and she was such a glamorous girl. So she was great. Peppa was another. She was another story. She was waiting for her coins. She wanted her coins. So
I do love that for Peppa. Tell me about meeting House Mother Juan Aviance and how you became a part of the House of Aviance.
So Trax Nightclub used to have a party on Sunday nights, and they called it Black Night. And that's where I used to see Juan, meet Juan all the time. But then I'm wearing long, long, long hair to the floor, parted down the middle.
Very Morticia Adams meets this cousin It.
You know, Naomi Campbell-ish, kind of, sort of, course.
Okay, okay.
You know, the Indian hair, you know. So we were like doing runway back and forth really severely. And Juan came over to me and said, do you want to be in the house? I said, I don't know. It was a house. And he told me what a house was. I said, oh, yeah, I'll be in the house. He said, well, your last name is Aviance now. And I said, okay, my name's Aviance. A month later after that, I moved into the actual House of Aviance. And we lived with four other people and on Harvard. And we just came really, really close and family to this day. Yeah. So Juan discovered me, basically. He discovered me.
Is this when you had I don't know if you want to talk about this or not, but you had a very crippling crack addiction for a while. Was that in D.C.?
Yeah, that was in D.C. Yeah, that was in D.C. And it was kind of like, it was rough. I didn't know. To be honest with you, I was just doing drugs, just to do drugs. Everybody did drugs, you know? And yeah, so yeah. I'm a hairdresser at the time also. And so my shampoo girl, she invited me to her house and that's what we would do. After we got off work, so we had to go to work the next morning. So, but this is also when I meet Jean-Philippe Aviance, who's another member of my house, and who's also this white kid who's a DJ, and he knew the club scenes and everywhere like that. And I was dressed as Diana Ross one night and had my backpack with my thing in the back. And so they took me out to their place in Maryland to go have like this morning party. I said, okay, fine. So mind you, these are all white kids. They're like, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, trying to smoke when I can't, you know, you can do anything with in front of people, whatever. And they're like, you can do what you want. It's fine. But you shouldn't do that anymore. I said, well, why shouldn't I? They said, you should do this instead. This is really gross. But just if you do something, do this instead. I said, well, why are you here? Just do this. I said, okay. And so that was acid. And it changed my life, girl. I saw things that I had never seen before, girl, and the imaginations and the gods and the elephants and we were in this field playing with water. It was amazing. It was good. I never looked back, girl, after that. I was like, this is
how you got off the crack.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Well, they do say, you know, that like LSD back in the 1950s and everything, that was used for psychiatric purposes. And I know, Randy, you've spoken about you have a friend who is an ayahuasca.
Do you still, are you still doing psychedelics?
You know, I'm 54 and I like my marijuana.
A child.
You know, I like my weed. I try to, you know, I am so blessed and so happy to be in front of you guys right now. So I just, when it comes to saying that I'm sober, I guess legally I'm not, but when it comes to like weed and all that stuff, but I don't do any hard stuff. I left that all alone.
That's called California sober when you still will do your weed, but that's all right. I completely understand. To me, psychedelics are a young man's game. In my 20s, I could do them. In my 30s, 40s, I couldn't. My 50s, the idea of tripping for 4 days on LSD, I just couldn't do it. There's no way.
It's not that I'm an addictive personality. It's just that I want people that like, I just go for it all. I go for it all until I go into like drop. And, you know, I just don't want to drop and I want to be able to get back up. You know, I'm lucky to be here and I'm lucky to be staying.
We don't even have to talk about that. Sometimes there's just sort of an interesting journey that people have.
I do think that moment of like switching from crack to LSD, I think that's actually really fascinating. And I know we don't want to talk about it too much, but I'd just love to know how one thing supplanted the other. Like if you know,
it was so dark. You know, we did it in an alley. We did it in like a stoop. You know, and smoked it. And then by the time it was gone. And you had to get more. And DC was the king of, that place was the king of it. So you got these rocks like this and you would smoke it down and get another one and get another one. It was just awful. And you just felt really like, ugh, afterwards and just like, ugh, you know, where acid, you did one thing and it's just like, I remember seeing like notes flying in the air, you know, and we're in this huge field and water coming off the top of the house. Because we had the sprinklers on, and it looked like diamonds in this ground. I was just like, girl, how do you want to, like, that was just, that was amazing. Mind you, I was going to ask that a lot after that, but, you know.
I know from experience, too, that the crack is a very dark high, and you do feel like crap afterwards. But there is something very clean about things like acid and LSD and mushrooms. And you wake up the next day, and you don't feel that hangover. You feel sort of light and airy.
Right.
Let's talk about your move then to Miami, because I remember you in South Beach as well, clubs like Warsaw, Paragon. Tell me about your experience going to Miami and the queens that you knew there.
I was supposed to go to New York, and I was going to Sound Factory in New York all the time. And I said, you know what? I am not ready for New York yet. Something needs to happen. So I met these kids that they're like, you should go to South Beach. South Beach is just this, is that, and those drag queens. And, you know, you can like get a job there and you work at a cafe, whatever. You just go. So I got a train ticket. I don't know why I got a train ticket, but I got a train ticket, Amtrak, and took the Amtrak all the way down there, which took forever. And it comes to find out nowhere near South Beach. I had to find my way to South Beach, which I didn't know. I had no idea what that meant. It was before cell phones, you know what I mean? So I just like found my way there, you know, got hitched a ride somewhere, got to South Beach. Ran into a dear friend of mine, and we're still friends to this day, Darvell Freeman, who does my makeup. And Darvell used to live in New York. He had just moved to South Beach, and he just protected me down there. And I, you know, started hanging out with Kitty Meow and everybody. And
I was going to say the great diva Kitty Meow, who I remember. She was a child in those days. Literally 16 or 17 years old in just the most fabulous drag queen. And now is the queen of South Beach. We've been around for so long that we know these people. Just what we've watched them grow. It's so fascinating.
It's amazing. And so Kitty and I, we were rivals when I first got there. So I wasn't doing bald headed drag yet. I was more doing like four wigs, you know, four wigs. I love the silhouette, you know, the girl on the map, the mud flap girl.
Yes.
That was like my favorite thing in the world. So I wanted to emulate her. So I love silhouettes. So I would hang out in the dark all the time and you would see a silhouette until the light got on me. And I'd be like, rah, I got you, girl. But I love silhouettes. So that was my drag. My drag was about that until I started performing and lip syncing, which I loved. And, you know, that just brought me back to my childhood. That was easy to do. I loved that. And then they had all those cafes and, you know, made a name for myself down there. Then I was ready. I was there for only 2 years. And then I was saying, I have to go to New York now. I went straight to New York.
What was South Beach like before it was, because this was probably like the beginning of, it was probably like still a bit like run down and.
So yeah, so I'm right in the middle of it when it's hot, basically. And yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was like, girl, there's just drag queens, circuit parties, and it's just craziness. You know, you're going to Disney World and you're going for a gay night, you know, because I went to like the first circuit parties ever. And those parties were crazy, you know.
The parties at Vizcaya, I remember the white party at Vizcaya, the castle there. And I remember just in, because I was there in 91, 92, and 93, and just those run down, broken down old Art Deco hotels that hadn't really come to life yet. The right. scene was, it was still a little grungy, and right. but all the New York queens would come down and visit, but there right. was still just this little scene that was bubbling up there that was so fabulous and so much fun.
Then Versace came there, and I remember yep. being on the beach, and I'm in a vital pink thong, and he's like, he sat right next to me, and I was just like, why is this guy sitting over here? I realized Versace, I'm like, oh my God, Versace. And he was just such a nice guy. He was such a sweetheart.
And then you come, like you said, you came to New York. And the interesting thing about your arrival in New York was that you straddled a lot of different scenes. You played with the club kids. You came to Disco 2000. You were at Webster Hall. You were at Sound Factory. You were at Trax, I believe, probably. I think I saw you there. We haven't really talked about Sound Factory that much on this show, but you were the queen of Sound Factory for a while there. Tell me about Sound Factory in the 90s.
So Sound Factory, you walked in, you paid $20 to get in. There was no guest list. The first time ever meeting Lee Bowery was there, actually. And he was amazing. You check your code or whatever, and then you had this long hallway with a pen light there and a pen light at the end of the runway. And it's just this little runway right before the DJ booth. And so people would see you come in of the two lights, you stand there, and then you go and disperse with the crowd. There's these stadium seats that went all the way down yeah. and around the corner. It's a very square club, okay? All dance floor, four stacks of speakers at each corner of the dance floor, and a little stage at the other side. The floor wasn't completely leveled. It was kind of like a little bumpy or something like that. Something was wrong with it. It wasn't like a floor, but it was a floor, but it was just different. Sound Factory had the most incredible music. Seth Jr. used to play songs that you'd go all week long. And then the next week you come back, you wanted to hear one song. And that song was like the biggest hit of the song of the season or the biggest hit of the next 2 weeks or whatever. And you'd hear songs like, you know, The Basement Boys, or just the music was so incredible, and the songs would last forever. Remember, James? These songs would last forever and ever, and people would lose their mind. At the end of the night, there was always a performance, and before I started doing them, there would be like some extravas would do them, or a ballet dancer or something. Somebody would do something very grand at the end of it, and then I did my little show to the pressure. And that's when Junior came out of the booth and gave me flowers. And so ever since that moment, I've always been his queen.
You were in the Secret video around this time. Madonna found you. Tell me about being in a Madonna video and how that changed your world.
So I met this guy named Danny. Danny something. Danny's the stylist. And Danny and I spent the night together that night. And the next morning, I said goodbye. We're at the hotel. And this is the morning of O.J. Simpson's little drama with the
white Bronco chase. Sure,
right. We're watching that on TV, and we're at the Paramount. And I'm like, "This, what is going on? Why is OJ? Why are they chasing OJ? What's going on?" And I'm gagging because OJ's like, you know, to the black community, he's somebody. He's OJ. You know what I mean? He's Mr. Orange Boys. You know what I mean? Anyway, I was like, "Wow, what did he do? What did he do?" And then, whatever, moving on. Then that night, Danny called me. He said, "Listen, I need you to take your portfolio to this casting director." I said, "Okay, now." I said, "Okay." That wasn't working, so I was like, "Yeah, I'll go." So I went down there and took my portfolio, and they said, "Okay, we'll call you back in a little bit." So they called me like an hour later, and they said, "You got the job." I said, "Oh, great." I said, "For who?" She said, "Well, we'll tell you tomorrow when give you the location." I said, "Oh, okay, I got the job." So the next morning, they called like 6:30 in the morning, something like crazy like that, and they said, "Can you be here at 9 o'clock? And I said, "Yeah, I can be there." Where? They gave me the address. So we're in Harlem. And I said, "Well, who's this for?" They said, "Well, did you sign the paper?" I said, "Yeah, I signed the paper, the NDA." And they said, "It's for Madonna." I was like, oh. What? No. Madonna girl, Madonna girl. What's the Madonna? So I go get ready and go to Harlem. And I'm in the 55th and 9th, so I go to Harlem. And there's a trailer there with my name on it and everything. I'm like, oh my God, this is too bad. It's like great. So all day goes by until 11 o'clock at night. They have not filmed me yet. They have not filmed me. No one's coming to my trailer. No one's coming. They've got me ready. Like my nails done like 6 times because I kept breaking them. So they were really long.
Wait, you've been sitting in your trailer since 9 o'clock and it's 11 o'clock at night and you still don't know anything?
Nothing. So I'm like this, okay. So Madonna wanted some more. She wanted some more food. So she had some more food brought over to the set and some black bean soup or something like that. So we're all waiting in line to get some soup. And we're in front of her truck, her bus. And they go, Kevin, Madonna wants to talk to you. I said, oh, no, I'm good. Like, that's what I said. I said, no, I'm good. They said, no, Madonna wants to talk to you. Come now. I'm like, oh. So I'm in drag, you know, titties, wig, nails, leopard outfit. Like, it's just like, girl, so you walk in and these hot ass boys are in there. Like, these New Yorkian boys, they were so hot. Like, 5 of them were in there. And then, I see the boy, I'm like, wow. And Madonna sitting in the corner of the bus, talk to this boy. And other boys are like here. But they're laughing at me though, because I look like, you know, I'm a drag queen, whatever. So I'm like, hey, hi, how are you? Hi, Madonna, how are you? She goes, hi. She said, where's the wardrobe girl? Where is she? She said, get her here right now. I'm like, oh God, what is she gonna do? What is she gonna do? She said, why does he look like a whore? I said, what? He's supposed to be like a call girl, or like a high society, you know, hooker or something like that. Like, that looks like a slut from the street. I was like, okay. She said, and his tits are too big. And they're like, what do you want us to do about it? She said, make them smaller. Give them a smaller bra. She said, we don't have another bra. She said, make it. She said, make it. I'll be here for another 15 minutes. She said, and I want to see it all before I leave. You know, 12 minutes come by. They have this makeshift, like, bra, this little thing on. This little thing. They said, like this. She goes, put it on. And I'm like, she said, right here, change. Take that off. I'm like, the boys are cackling. They're just like that. And, so goes, and they put the bra on me. They took the bra off. And they put the bra on me. And she goes, she said, don't put on no stuffing. Just let it be natural. Like, let me just a little. She came over. She's like, you know, fix it. And she said, put the top back on. She said, and all that gold jewelry that you're supposed to wear, put that all on him. Every last bit of it. I want it back. All the gold jewelry on. I said, okay. So she put all the gold jewelry on and it fixed my wig. And she said, that's much better. I got to go. She's nice meeting you. Thank you for being the video. And that's it. So.
Was it much better?
Yeah, it was much better. I looked like, I felt good. You know, I felt really good. The tits were really too big. They made me like, it was really bad, like really bad.
So Mother Madonna knew how to style you.
She knew. I mean, she there was a reason why she wanted me to come off a certain way. You know, I mean, the character meant a lot to her. From what I know, they said Naomi was supposed to play that part, and so.
Oh, so you were Naomi's stand-in. After that, it's your first dance hit, Cunty.
Steve Travolta gave me calls, and he said Jarrell Black was looking for someone to do some vocals on his new track. And so Franklin Fuentes usually does it for him, but him and Franklin had a falling out. I didn't know that at the time, but I said, yeah, I'll meet up with him. So I went to his house uptown and he had some chicken and some grape soda. We sat there and ate and just, you know.
Chicken and grape soda. I love it.
And then he played some beats for me. And I was just like, ooh, girl, these beats are hot. Dun, dun. Ooh, they're hot. And they were hot. And I was like, wow, I love it. So Cunty. He goes, well, that's the name of the song. I said, oh, okay. And so he said, let's listen to some more of it. I said, well, it makes me feel like a daisy. It makes me feel like a damn kept going on rose. Oh no, I can't. He said, well, let's record right now. So, and we recorded it right then and there.
My favorite, and I think I mentioned this at the beginning, that it was your Dindada, your version of Dindada. And it's so interesting to me because the original one I was a 16-year-old gay boy in Fort Lauderdale going to the clubs. This song has a really special place for me because it reminds me of that period in my life where I was just exploring the clubs and just that feeling of one song. It just and everyone just coming together. It's like a church. You mentioned that about Sound Factory, that one song at the end of the night. But the song to me, it just sounds like a number, with the way he sings it, it's nonsense words that just sound good together. But when you sing it, it sounds like it's a whole language and you understand every word that is being said. You're telling a story. And it's like, did you feel that? Did you feel like you were really telling a story with each of these words and they meant something to you?
You are the first person to ever say that to me. And I am so amazed. It is true. It's very true. I used to, as a kid, love the song. And I love freestyle music. And freestyle was my favorite thing to listen to. So this song was like a freestyle R&B type feeling. And the history behind the song is that he's a drummer and of a studio session. And so they were testing drums. So he's going, da-da-da-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da. He's trying to get the same tone as the thing. They recorded him, and they made it as a joke, and they made it into a song. He was like, okay, well, he performed it once at Studio 54. That was it. Boom, 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 boom. The song goes into, one shot wonder, but it's definitely one of those dancer records, So when I started traveling, doing drag, that was one of the songs I used in my show. Was that I used to I lip synced it for years and years and years, and people would freak out me lip syncing this male song, but for some reason it worked, I love doing that.
In a world full of straight people, aren't you glad there's WOW Presents Plus, the number one place in the world to see Drag Race? And so much more. Subscribe to WOW Presents Plus. Still only $4.99. Subscribe today as streamed on TV.
And then when I got to record it, I had to work with I worked with Louis Ballo first, and it was really bad. And so Gomi knew to put me with a jazz singer who could scat. And so for 2 months, I took scatting lessons and kind of developed that, and then went and recorded it and hit it right on the number. So the song means a lot to me. That's why, it is like a language, because I used to say, if someone steps into your face, you can da-da-da them in your face. I just say that. But when someone stepped in my face, I shut my mouth and let them beat me because they were going to kill me. So it was kind of like, it was really a weird, weird thing for me because I tried to use it as instead of people getting into fights, use it as some sort of like language to like defend yourself, So, but for me, it wasn't that was the subject. That was the story.
This is a little side thing, but that song is quite special to me and Randy too, because it was playing at the Pyramid. It was like one, as James says, it was one of those songs like that and Hip Hop, Don't Stop, Man Parish, and Planet Rock. But George Krantz, Randy, was signed to the same label the Pop Tarts were signed to. Personal records.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And there were so many records that they put out that sort of, because it was only until you covered it, it was very much like a record that only a few people knew. Do you know what I mean? It was like, it was a staple, but it wasn't widely known. And I think you really gave it this whole new lease of life.
In fact, I think your version is probably the more iconic of the two now. That's fascinating. Let's talk about the events that happened on June 10th. 2006, the day of your gay bashing. Tell me the events that led up to it and what happened.
I was actually shooting the cover for HX Magazine, which is like my third cover I did for Gay Pride, basically. So this is like the third time I've been on. So I'm really happy about it. I'm shooting with Carl Giant, and they gotten all these like Sydney Precious Stones and all this stuff, and put the circus theme on my face. And so I had to lay down on the ground. He beat my face, and the pictures came. So that's what we was left with, And then we go to eat sushi afterwards, and we go to the Phoenix. And after Phoenix, we walk to the Cock. And the Cock hadn't moved yet. So the Cock was on 12th and A still. Was that the first one? The first place or the second place?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh huh.
Okay. So after we leave the cock, we walk to 14th and 1st and we disperse. You know, it's bye girl, bye girl, bye girl, bye girl. And then I walk down 1st Avenue towards 20, whatever, to go, because I live at 23rd and 7th. So I just wanted to walk home. And I remember having my new Balenciaga bag I just got, new phones, computer, you know, helmet length boots, you know, New York gives you the sample sales. I had that on. So I'm just feeling myself and I see this guy, four guys talking to this white girl, four black guys. And I'm like this, okay, just keep walking, girls, keep walking. And you know, I see them, I'm like, and they have spray painting. So
right.
I walk past them. They said, "You ain't Diesel, son." And I was like, whatever. Just keep walking. So I kept walking. Something told me to turn around, though. As I'm walking, I turn around. A paint can went by my head. Then a trash bag went by my head. And then another paint can thing went by my head. I said, "Okay, you missed. You missed three times. Keep walking. Da, 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 da." You know how the rules are, girl. Go. They were like, "No, we don't get you, faggot." I was like this, okay, this doesn't sound too good. So I just kept walking backwards the whole time. And then I realized, I said, these boys are not going away. Like this, you either shoo them away or, I said, this is not good. And then I stepped off the curb. The one guy's walking towards me. He's so mad, I can feel the heat from his face. And then the other three are just like, they're gone. And my other foot stepped off the curb. I got hit in my back three or four times. And then, as I'm going down, they're kicking me down, so they're kicking me in the head over and over and over again with those Air Force One sneakers, and I pass out.
When you woke up, were you in the hospital? Where did you wake up?
No, I woke up in the middle of the street. People were yelling at me, "You got to get up, you got to get up. The cars are going around you. No one's picked me up yet. So the cars are going around, they're going to hit you, you got to get up." And so I jump up. And I went to the top, my jaw was everywhere. And I was like, "Oh, my jaw. Cops came. I walked back to the sidewalk and sat down. I said, Did you get the guys? My jaw. And the cops left. They left. I don't know if they thought there was like a drug deal. I don't know what they thought. They just left. I said, "Why did they leave?" I said, this one guy said, "You need to get to the hospital. Your head is swelling up and it's not going down. It's like getting bigger and bigger. You need to get to the hospital." And Beth Israel's right there. So I go into Beth Israel. I didn't have insurance. Two black women came from the back with short hair and pink outfits.
Did you walk to the hospital?
Yeah, I did. It was right there. It was like a block, like a half a block away.
And nobody was helping you to get to the hospital?
No. It's just somebody that was helping me there. And then I called my agent at the time, Joseph. I told Joseph what was going on. I called my boyfriend, Yassine, and they came. But the two women that came and got me in the back did not work there. My mom had just died, and her best friend had died before that. And I really believe these two women were my mom and her best friend. I don't know why. These women did not work there at all. And I was trying to find them because I wanted to tell them thank you and give them to the back, and I couldn't find them anywhere. So that was really weird. And then I had to go to surgery. My jaw was broken in four different places, hairline fractures. And then mouth was wired shut for three months.
So wait, what were the other injuries? You said you had hairline fractures. And
I had four hairline fractures in each corner of my, like here. My legs had been popped out that way, you know, like.
Oh, wow.
Way, like instead of like, you know, you sit like this, but popped that way. I don't know how that happened. And then my thigh had been pulled back that way. I don't know what they did to me, to be honest with you. I don't know if that was from the kicking. I don't know, because I was already passed out already. So when I woke up, I didn't know I had all those injuries and stuff. But it's the stuff afterwards, James, that was hard. All the PS, whatever it's called. And the
PTSD, yes, all the
PTSD. And all that crazy stuff that I did not even know what to do with. That's what made me really crazy after that.
But the thing about it is that you can't keep a good queen down. And the next week, you had a triumphant appearance at Gay Pride. And right. Even though your mouth was wired shut, you were able to give a very rousing speech that the crowd went bananas. Tell me about what it took to get up out of the hospital and get to Gay Pride, even though your mouth was wired shut.
I was already living in a hotel because the police had me hidden somewhere. So they didn't know what the deal was with this whole beating and everything. And the city was going to back the trial and everything. So they wanted to keep me safe. And so they got me said about what I do gay pride, you know, because the people were like really upset about this whole thing. I said, you know, how am I going to do gay pride? How am I going to do gay pride? You know, I can't. We'll put you on something. We'll let you sit. I said, okay. So, but the 2 days before that was the rally that I spoke at. And just so many people came out. I couldn't believe how many people came out. It was amazing. And so I just couldn't believe it. And so they, when I spoke, you know, I couldn't really speak, you know, and that's it. I mean, they understood, I guess. It's just, I was still in the throes of like all the, it was all such a mess in my head. You know what I mean? And I was on pills and it was just crazy trying to keep a, you know, front up. But then they wanted me to do gay pride. And it's like, okay, they put me on this elephant that was on an elephant that was on a, like a thing, like a fake elephant on a dolly or whatever that just moved down. But after it was all said and done, the whole thing, I had to go back into surgery and get my mouth rewired shut again.
Oh, no. But it was such a rallying moment for the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. I remember it really mm-hmm. rocked everybody. And it was on, you know, every blog in 2006, every gay magazine covered it. Everybody was talking about it. It was something that it was one of us. It was one of our community who had been hurt. And it really I get choked up thinking about it now as to what it meant that you were able to, that you survived it and you were able to turn it around in the way that you did.
The two attacks that happened afterwards, both the guys died. And so, you know, it felt very,
there, but for the grace of God, you know, I mean, it could have been you that died. Yeah.
Was it the same guys then who attacked other people?
No.
All right. Different attacks.
One was the first one, a grinder attack. The guy picked up some boys on grinder and they met him at a certain spot and they killed him.
I remember that. Yeah.
And the other one was another gay attack, like another hate crime. So they killed him too. So they're both black. So.
Now, what happened to the guys that attacked you?
By the time I came up to do my little thing, they had already said they were guilty already, so they didn't need me. So I wanted to see their faces, but people didn't think it was smart. So,
are they still in prison?
They're out now. They did their full time.
That's interesting.
You said that in the aftermath, the immediate aftermath, you were on pills, and that you were saying that sort of coming to terms with it in the longer term was the real challenge. And I wanted to ask you about that and what it was and how it was you think you got through it, because you are incredibly strong. And I just think how someone grapples with something like that, it would just be great to hear about.
My life at the time was riding so high. It was like things were going so well. I mean, it was like, it was incredible. Like that was giving me to do it, like a movie or something like that, or something was happening.
You had done Flawless with Robert De Niro, right?
Something else was, yeah, I did Flawless, but I had some other stuff that was happening. I had another album deal and, you know, I had Shoe Line coming out and, you know, I had a lot of stuff going on. And then my life just came to a halt after that beating. And I just felt very like, I felt defeated in a lot of ways. People came to my rescue. They were clapping for me. They were, you know, everyone was so happy I was alive, but I was taking it all the wrong way. Because I didn't perform, I didn't do what I needed to do. And so I had to go fix my head. My head was really, really messed up. And I just had to like work with some doctors and just like make myself normal, like, or just not beat myself up so much, you know what I mean? Just to like, it wasn't my fault. I didn't deserve this. And, you know, it was just craziness. And my whole life just came to done. And so I lived in Florida for a while. Tried to come back to New York, did not. New York was going through a change, and I just left again. And then,
but you know, the next year you also had another triumphant comeback when you performed your new song at Pride, and that must have been a good full circle moment for you, where you were starting to come out of the darkness again.
Right. So there was another song between that. So there's some time between that. So
Well, no, exactly. The song was Strut. Didn't you come back with Strut?
I did come back with Strut. You did. You're totally all right. Strut was okay. I mean, Strut was fine. Strut was enough to get me back into the city. And then it didn't really catch on, but it was cute. It was fun. That show was fun. But Alive was the one that really, like, did it, because that's 9/11. You know what I mean? So, and
you are alive. You, man, the song is correct.
Right, right, right. I am alive. There's so much, you know, there's so much time has gone by. And, you know, when you have something like when you come back to New York, you know, and you're getting back on the, I came back to New York to get my hips replaced. You know what I mean? And I didn't really was going to go back to drag at all. But I realized that you can't kill the drag out of you. You can't just say turn it on, turn it off. It's it was such part of my life. It is part of my life, you know, being part of the cloth. That's me, you know. And I said, okay, well, I guess I'm going to get back on this pole again. You know what I mean? So I started working on that, getting myself back together, getting my hips replaced and everything. And, you know, seeing all the kids again, la, 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 la. It was great. And, you know, people were freaking out because I'm, you know, hobbling around stuff. But it took like 2 years to get my hips replaced. And then I wanted it again. I wanted to do something. And then the pandemic happened. And I think it's so weird. The pandemic to me was like this time for me to just rest and work on myself and just like give myself a break and just like chill and work on myself. You know what I mean? And that's what I did. I did art. I took classes online, DJing or songwriting class. I tried to take a sewing class. I couldn't get through it because I needed to do it hands on. You know what I mean? But, told myself I was going to be a butterfly when I come out of this whole thing, you know? So that's what I did. I worked
well, and in fact, you were a butterfly when you came out of it, because let's move on to the headline here is Beyonce. How did that come about? How did you get the call?
I think I never got the call. I never knew anything about it. The story is that when I found out about it, it was the day, the night of. I still didn't understand because they sent me the track listing. I didn't understand what the track listing was and why my name was there. I didn't understand it. I went to sleep. I woke up. I had the album in my phone, in my computer. I listened to it. I'm like really moved by it because it's like really touching me. This album's like really touching me. I'm hearing all these samples. I'm hearing her singing the way she's very different. I'm like, why am I resonating with this thing so much? And then I hear the song about her uncle. And I'm like, yeah, her uncle died today. I knew that. I said, let me go back. So I went back to the beginning of the album again. And I'm like, okay, show me love. I hear, I said, so it's like a little dance tribute, black, gay. Da, da, da. And then I hear cunty. Something, cunty. I pass out. I couldn't believe it. My friend was here and I was, he's like, are you okay? You just hit the floor. I said, okay, did I just hear cunty? He goes, yeah. You want to hear it again? Do you? Played again, and I just couldn't believe it. I was angry. I was mad. I was upset. I was happy. I was like, yeah, I didn't know about it. I didn't know, but I love it. And I love her. And I was like, all these emotions at one time. But then I realized, you know, then I just couldn't stop listening to it over and over and over again. And then I realized how many times cunty's in the damn song. And then she uses cunty and feeling the moans. Like she really used the song. And I'm like this going, oh my God, she got in. She really got in. And I love the song. And then I hear Honey, Moi Renee on the end of it, and I start crying. Because Moi Renee, if she was around, she would live for it. She would live for it. She would have been like, yes, darling, you in the front, me on the end, darling. It's perfect. I can hear her. She was just one of the fiercest queens I've ever met in my life. And I just was so happy to be on this track with her. Then Kevin Prodigy's on it from the ballroom scene now. Who's a wonderful, wonderful, incredible talent. Yeah, it's been incredible. I mean, the whole thing has been.
And I imagine that at a certain point, your phone just must start blowing up. You probably got 10,000 phone calls just that day.
Everybody from all corners of the world. I mean, you know, you realize how many people you've met when they're calling you about Beyonce. You know what I mean? And just like the phone was ringing off the hook. My DMs, my emails, everything was just crazy. Then my publicist, my long, Len Evans calls. He goes, okay, so we have to get to work. We have to do this. We have to do this. I said, Len, wait a minute. Calm down. We're not doing anything. I'm done. You know, we ain't doing all this. Kevin, you've got to ride this wave right now. I said, let me think about it for a while. He said, you don't have time to think about it. We got to do this now. I said, yeah, I have a day. I'm not really worried. I'm not going to rush anything. Just like, whatever. So I go to the phone with him and I'm like, then my friend was here going, girl, are you stupid? I said, no, I just want to make sure this is not something so, you know.
But you have to ride it when you're hot. All of a sudden you are hot again and you have to take advantage of it.
I had, you know, I've had so many of these little rides before in my life, James. I was just kind of like, you know, like, okay, be like, da, da, da. But it wasn't, this B thing was the biggest thing probably ever happened to my life, because she was really into it, and she reached out, and they, like, it's really fierce. You know what I mean? It's not just some little like track, somebody just using your track. It was like, she was doing something and she was going to follow through with it. And she did, you know?
It's a love letter to the Black queer community, you know? Yeah, and she really did. You get the feeling that she really appreciates you. She really appreciates T.S. Madison, Big Frida. Right. She got it. She gets the Black queer scene.
Right.
And so James, it is. It's such a beautiful moment.
And she took everyone and she raised them up. This is the end world. You will listen to them. They have a story. They're beautiful. The music's great. Just, you're going to listen to these people. These people, you know, these people already. They're your friends. They're your brothers. They're your sisters. They're your brothers. It was amazing what she did. And I just like, I mean, other people have done this before. You know, they went to the gay community and like put their, you know, and put their, and been very advocates for us and everything. There's something about this Beyonce thing, like you said, that makes it so like wow. You know, because it took a Black woman to do this. You know what I mean? That's the only person that could do this. That is the billionaire. That's a status that everyone lives for. They go like this. Because if she didn't do that, I don't know where we would all be right now. You know what I mean? Because this album, Renaissance, has really brought back the Renaissance way of artists, of Black artists, of Black, it's been like the soundtrack for this new wave of things going on in the Black community. And it's just amazing. It's amazing.
Randy, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, now, what about the royalty check?
First of all, stop counting my money. Second of all, I am, everything's fine. That's all I'm going to say. Everything's good. Everything's wonderful.
That's really good. And also, you are now working with Brandon Voss as well, right?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Brandon, they reached out to me and I had a meeting with them and it's great. It's good. You know, it's perfect, you know? They're not trying to make me another, you know, they're not trying to make me one of the girls, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like I'm coming in as a vintage girl with her own thing and trying to do it, and they get me. So it's really, really great.
But it's so great. It's so great that, I mean, you are such an icon, and this idea of you being out there and having this, you know, it's not a moment because it's more than a moment, but you know, there's so few people who even survive, you know, for whatever reason. So in the business that we're all in, mm-hmm. in different ways, mm-hmm. it's sort of just surviving and lasting is like, it's worth currency.
And it is your own reward that you are still here. And interestingly, you are now, you know, I've known you as a child. I've known you as in the prime of your life. And now you are a grand dame. You are the Dorian Corey Pepa LaBeija of our times. You know, it's something to realize that you are now, you know, you've said you're 54 years old. What, 52, 54?
54.
And
child.
Yeah, but you are entering into your grand dame phase. You know, this is, you are now somebody that the young kids can point to and say, this is something to aspire to. This is somebody who has been through tragedy, she's been through triumph, she's been through everything, and you're still here, and you're still fabulous, and you are still out there.
These kids are, I don't know, the kids I knew when I was a kid weren't too informing. They weren't too nice. They were a little shady. They were a little like all about themselves. They were a little like, they didn't know the handbook. You know what I mean? They were just trying to do it the best way they could. These kids, with that little cell phone they have, they are informed. They know what's going on. They care. They know their history. They're gay, straight, Black, white, green, yellow, whatever this brain. They are just so, they're inspiring, because it's kind of like, wow. Out of all this drama and all this kiki and all this shit out here, these kids are still developing, and they just know what's going on, and they're so appreciative to it. It's amazing.
That's interesting because so often we hear about this generation being entitled and narcissistic and these social media influencers. And it's nice to hear that you have a really positive experience with the kids today. I find that really beautiful.
I was really like, you know, I was always taught that you want something first, go see what the kids are doing. And so with all the ballroom stuff that's going on, the way they're dancing now and the way they do things and the way they want to do it, want to be a part of it, and how they take tens very seriously. Like the tens, getting their tens is very important. If that's what the people need out here in the world, the tens, then they should be teaching stuff at school, because these kids are like, they bring it, and they bring it with their brain. The females that are out there, amazing. And so they have the females and the trans people. It's just like amazing. It's like yesteryear, like way, way back. I remember New York being, when I first got to New York, going to the pier and how joyous it was at the pier. You know what I mean? But now that feeling is in these little kids. You know what I mean? And these little kids are so like, you know, they're 18, 19, 20, 21 going out. They're so sweet, so nice. They're so appreciative.
I love that.
Yeah, they're great.
I love hearing that. Randy Fenton, do you have any follow-up questions? Do you have any thoughts, any final?
It's just nice getting to spend time with you. Aww. And hearing, you know, hearing these stories and kind of knowing them. But I'm really happy that we got this chance.
Exactly, yes. Everything Randy says is so true. It's such a privilege and a pleasure to spend some time with you. Like, and I do think survival is the word of the day. Like, it's just about still being here.
Yeah, the first time I ever did drag was in fifth grade. And I was in fifth grade. I stole my sister's dress and I stole her platform shoes and I sang I Will Survive in fifth grade. At a talent contest during the day we had the contest, and I won it when I was a kid. So when you say survive, it's
from fifth grade to now,
you are still winning that contest. Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's so great to see you, and I love you so much, and I
love
you forever and ever and ever.
All my heart, babies. I love you so much. You know, you're also you are an inspiration yourself, sweetheart. So just know that you are. I see you now, and I'm just like this. All those nights and all those things, just like, you know, amazing.
Well, that's our poll quote. Blake, don't you dare cut that out of the edit. that's how we're going to start it.
Thank you. Love you.
Bye, boys.
Bye.